Welcome. My name is Kent Kleinman, and I am the dean of the college, newly named PAA, Planning, Art, and Architecture. It is my great pleasure to introduce Professor, Dr., and President David Skorton and welcome him to this significant event in the life of the Department of City and Regional Planning. I assume that President Skorton hardly needs an introduction from this group. He has been in the forefront of many urgent, difficult, and complex issues during the last 4 years, and you could not have heard, seen, or read his words, even if you tried really hard. I first encountered President Skorton's style in the fall of 2008 when, as a freshman dean, I was told by the president, one, the endowment had lost 30% of its value, two, conditions were as dire as anything the university had experienced in decades, three, this was surely a lousy time to be a dean, and especially a new one, and four, that there was really only one prudent thing to do, namely spend more money on student financial aid. And with that, $35 million were taken out of the corpus and put into the pockets of deserving students at Cornell. This action certainly captured my attention, and I hope it captured yours as well. It would have been easy to equate prudence with inaction and to forget that in times of crisis, we are judged not by survival, but by our commitment to our core values. So I think it is no coincidence that President Skorton is here to welcome this particular gathering and to inaugurate this auspicious event. For your passions and his have a great deal in common, a commitment to social equity, an appreciation for the role of environment in supporting a healthy and stimulating life, a belief in the institutions of civil society, and a conviction that the work of the Academy must infuse itself into the world at large to effect positive change, even in challenging circumstances. Please help me welcome the 12th president of Cornell University, Dr. David Skorton.
Thanks a lot. That's actually took me off my equilibrium a little bit. What a wonderful introduction. I remember that day, and you stayed too, which is fabulous. It's fabulous. PAA, I love that. I just love that. Well, I am very sincerely honored to be able to welcome you back home and to have learned in the last 3 or 4 days as I was getting ready for this brief set of remarks about the proud and incredible history of this set of endeavors. I knew quite a bit about the more recent part of the history. I was so proud to see the engagement in post-Katrina Ninth Ward, New Orleans, and of course in Haiti more recently, where you may know that Cornell Medical School started the world's first HIV clinic in the developing world 31 years ago in Port-au-Prince. And to see this unit of Cornell following up in its way, and also to know all the things that I have learned about the many, many other milestones, a few of which I'm going to recount for both for me and you. I want to welcome all of you back, and I understand that I can recognize Paul Farmer, MRP 71, CEO of the American Planning Association. Is Paul here? Well, in absentia, we want to welcome him. I welcome him back to campus as well. This long history, as the dean implied, is very closely attuned to that part of Cornell's heart and soul, which has to do with reaching out beyond the walls of the academy to do something for people outside of our own campus. And in its focus on development and the daily life of communities and its global perspective and its outreach efforts, this is part of the land-grant mission of the university, and how like Cornell that one of the so-called endowed colleges, not the colleges that are directly supported by the state of New York, is so active and is such a world leader in the land-grant tradition. This is a department with a very strong sense of social responsibility, and although I knew that in the abstract, I didn't know the details until recently. As you probably know, city and regional planning is the fourth oldest planning department in the world. You know about the international esteem that you and others have caused it to have, and you know how its numerous doctoral level graduates have populated the world of academia in this field throughout the country and beyond. You know that the program is known for its strengths in international development planning, as we've mentioned, community economic development planning, as we've mentioned, planning theory and history, historic preservation planning, and action-based research, to mention just a few that I could identify. And I noticed that you and the program have sought to balance physical planning and planning based in the social sciences. I don't know enough to know if it's unique, but very unusual and compelling to me. I understand that it offers the nation's only graduate program in regional science, and its master's program in historic preservation planning is the second oldest in the United States. CRP also offers a very highly regarded undergraduate major, as I'm sure you know, urban and regional studies that gives students an understanding of the complexities of cities and regions around the world. Now, this is a long tradition, but I want to say that it's been greatly augmented by Kent Kleinman's vision and effective way of executing his vision. The CRP has many, many connections across the Cornell campus and holds a very distinctive place in the campus community on a traditional basis, and that's been very strongly reinforced in the scant few years that Kent has been here. The faculty collaborate with colleagues in nearly every Cornell college and offers joint graduate degree programs with the program in real estate and the Department of Landscape Architecture. It's the only department on this campus, a very comprehensive campus, that's explicitly focused on urban and regional spaces and providing an integrative understanding of the issues facing contemporary urban societies. It would be hard to find a more important and compelling problem around the world right now. The course offerings, as you probably know, but I want to tell you this good news, continues to attract students from all over the campus. And virtually all of the courses, graduate and undergraduate, are enrolled right up to the limit. And there's really no better sign of the relevance and quality of what the faculty are doing than how the students vote with their feet. Now, the department also has been at the forefront of several of Cornell's larger outreach efforts, and I mentioned a couple of them earlier in these remarks. This anniversary, of course, is a wonderful occasion for looking back on the distinguished history of CRP and looking into its future as well. I hope you enjoy all the activities planned. I would like to see, so that I can bask in your strength of character, a show of hands of those who went on the 2 o'clock bike ride today. Wow. And you look fabulous too. You look really fabulous too. I want you to feel free to stay warm inside and eat, drink, relax the rest of the time. You've shown your mettle. The rest of you have a lot to prove. I hope you have a fabulous time. It's wonderful, wonderful to welcome you back home. I hope to run into you around the campus today and tomorrow. And thanks very much, Kent and Dr. Donaghy, for allowing me to be a part of this today. Go Big Red. Thanks.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David Squetton. I will turn the lectern over to the real experts in a moment. However, I want first to make two short remarks. The first is to note that 75 years ago, there was barely an academic discipline called planning, and that you, this department, played a central role in defining the intellectual domain known as progressive planning. It is a testament to the success of the faculty and graduates, in other words, you, that city and regional planners are now seen as central and crucial to addressing today's urban problems. Many of you are ambassadors of this grand accomplishment, and you should be justly proud. But I don't think there can be much doubt that the challenges facing today's planners are of an unprecedented scale, scope, complexity, and urgency. They are what Horst Riddle some 40 years ago called wicked problems, although I think arguably they are more wicked than even he imagined. We know that we are now predominantly urbanized, and we know that we inhabit conglomerations of unprecedented size. A city of 10 million is now a mid-sized city. But the issue is not, I believe, of size alone. The question, admittedly much simplified, can be stated, what has become of the central modernist trope signified by that key word, order? A term that once gave architects, planners, and people involved in shaping the world confidence that social systems could be mapped legibly onto formal systems. In a world in which traditional tools of planning are increasingly challenged, the metrics and the forms and the values of urban order are very much subjects of debate. I believe firmly that the planning faculty and students at Cornell are once again being called to rethink the theories and methods of planning. And my job, and I mean this seriously, is to make sure that the department is primed for the task. That is my first remark. My second comment is even shorter and more personal. I have had the pleasure of working closely for 2 years with the current chair of the planning department, Professor Kieran Donaghy. There are very few people who can spike meetings on cost reduction with vaudeville jokes, who can render accounting terms in Latin, and who can cite Gadamer on the census communis while writing multi-million dollar EPA grants. It should bring you comfort to know that your current chair can do all these things. Please welcome my colleague and Professor Kieran Donaghy to the lectern.
Good afternoon, alumni, colleagues, friends, students, anyone who's wandered into this building this afternoon. It's great to see you all, and I hope you will enjoy the celebrations we have planned for you. I'd like to thank President Skorton and Dean Kleiman for their kind congratulatory remarks and also for their challenges to us as we confront the next period of our department's legacy. Before going any further, I should note that Sarah Subin has asked me to remind everyone that after the events transpiring here in Statler Auditorium, everyone should proceed over to Hartell Gallery in Sibley Dome for the alumni poster session and exhibition. This session will be followed by a networking reception in the Herbert F. Johnson Museum of Art, and we will reconvene here tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. to entertain alternative perspectives on the future of planning education. But turning to my duties of the moment, it is my pleasant task to introduce our speaker for the afternoon, Professor Emeritus of Cornell University's Department of City and Regional Planning, John Reps. John Reps graduated with the first class of MRP students in 1947. After conducting research on British planning for several years and serving as planning director in Broome County, he joined the Department of City and Regional Planning in 1952 and chaired the department for the next 12 years. He taught in the department until his retirement in 1987 and served the College of Architecture, Art, and Planning, or is that PAA? I forgot. And the university in many capacities over his career. He was also active as a planning consultant, for which he had been recognized by the New York Upstate Chapter of the American Institute of Planners, and he was a member of the Ithaca City Planning Board. Professor Reps has been extraordinarily productive as a scholar, authoring 16 books and winning numerous prizes for their contributions to our understanding of planning. He has also done much to make available digital copies of primary source materials, very generously so, to other scholars so as to advance the field of planning history. In 1984, the Association of the Collegiate Schools of Planning recognized John Reps with its biennial award for distinguished service to education and planning, making him only the second person to be so honored. In 1996, the American Planning Association cited him as the father of modern American city planning history and designated him as a planning pioneer. John Reps continues to be a valued presence in the department and contributes to both the scholarly dialogue and the bonhomie of which we all partake. John, we all look forward to hearing your account of the history of Cornell University's Department of City and Regional Planning, please join me in welcoming a truly great man of planning, John Reps.
Enough already. Kieran, if you do funerals, I'd like you at my graveside. It was an honor to have President Scorton here. On other occasions when we've attracted presidential attention, it's generally been bad news. This time, there was a different message, and I was delighted to hear it. We're here to celebrate a notable event in the history of American city planning. I am referring, of course, to the 445th anniversary of that event. And would any of you like to identify that? Now, let's not see the same hands all the time. Let's see any hand. Well, we'll have to do that course again. Yes. No, this is American city planning. It is the it's the planning of St. Augustine in 1565. Well, we'll give you a prize of some sort, Anne. Good for you. Congratulations. Well, of course, we are celebrating another anniversary that's closer to us. And there are several other dates that are important. Cornell University received its charter 145 years ago. Architecture became a college at Cornell 116 years ago. Planning as a 75-year-old department has thus existed for more than half of the life of Cornell and nearly two-thirds of the time of the College of Architecture. We're no longer the new kid on the block. We've become a firm part of this institution. Further, beginning in 1938, when Gilmore Clark, the founder of the department, became dean of the college, four others of its members have served as dean: Tom Mackesy, Casey Parsons, Ian Stewart as acting dean during the illness and death of Jason Seeley from the art department, and most recently, Porus Opadwala. The other five deans, including Burnham Kelly, a planner, all came from the outside. That record, one that I doubt is not fully appreciated throughout the university, suggests where the intellectual and administrative talent of the college can be found. Well, planning had rather tentative beginnings at Cornell. We know that someone in the engineering school shortly after World War I was teaching a course. We know that there was a course by 1928 in our college, a course quaintly called a seminary in city planning. I encountered that terminology when I came here. Some courses were labeled seminaries, others were seminars. I never knew the difference. Probably there wasn't. Well, that was taught for 3 years by the former chairman of the Milwaukee Planning Commission, who was an architect and became a teacher here. And after he retired, outside speakers came in and gave a series of lectures. One of those was Gilmore Clark. And Gilmore Clark's name is an important one in our history. A Cornell graduate, we always say, in landscape architecture. It was not called that at the time, but that is more or less what he studied. And of course, that's what he became, a prominent consultant on all kinds of projects in New York City and New York State and elsewhere. It is true that a few students in architecture were permitted, if they persisted, to do their senior thesis on projects that had some city planning application. But no member of the faculty was teaching this subject in 1933, when this country hit the bottom of the Depression, a depression, by the way, that makes our present difficulties look, not, if not quite trivial, at least certainly in a different perspective. Little building was taking place in the Depression, and the enrollment in the college declined drastically. And I think that was in the mind of Dean George Young when in August 1933, after some preliminary conversations, he approached Frederick Keppel, the president of the Carnegie Corporation, as it then was, it later became a foundation. And he was seeking funds to start a planning program that would be based in the College of Architecture, but would be open to students from other departments and would rely in part on teachers, at least occasionally, from engineering, from arts, and perhaps from law. I have a copy of the letter that he sent to Keppel. He sent a copy to President Livingston Ferrand. It was a 5-page single-spaced letter. It was a very, very detailed proposal. Now, there are three or four places where one can read the substance of this, but I will quote a paragraph from the November of 1934 issue of the New York Times, which carried a long story about this based primarily on a news release that had been prepared at Cornell. So here is what he is telling Keppel is going to be the nature of the program. The basic idea is that actual achievement in city and regional planning is not dependent to any great extent on specially trained experts. That such work is necessarily collaborative and must depend upon the cooperative effort of many diversely trained individuals united through informed interest. That the leadership of such a group will fall not to the person most fully equipped in a technical sense, but rather to that one who emerges from the group because of talent for leadership and coordination. And that therefore one possible and promising educational approach is to present the planning idea to our future merchants, bankers, business and professional men on whom the responsibility for achievement must finally rest and among whom many of the necessary leaders will eventually be developed. Now, Gilmore Clark and Keppel knew one another. They were friends. They were both members of the Century Club in New York City. They saw one another frequently. And Clark, many years later, in an oral history tape at Columbia University, recalled a conversation that the two men had in the club car of the 20th Century Limited on a trip returning to New York from Chicago. That train, by the way, went faster than any modern train that we have today. So much for progress. Clark said that he then argued with Keppel that the input to city planning should include doctors in preventative medicine. I'm sorry the president has left, he's a planner. The sociologist, the civil engineer, the architect, the landscape architect, the real estate operator, and the lawyer. My guess is, and it is only that, is that Clark told Young that if he approached Keppel, he might be able to get some money. So that seems to me to have started the music for the always delicate gavotte of academics dancing around a pile of foundation money. And the Carnegie Corporation agreed to the request, and $25,750 was made available to Cornell for the first 3 years of a program. And to begin and lead it, the university appointed Gilmore Clark as a professor on a part-time basis. And he began to teach in the spring term of 1935. He offered two courses, city and regional planning. That was a 2-hour lecture course and a 1-hour seminar. Now, I have Clark's report of the first year of teaching, a quite detailed report. It tells us that Clark gave 17 of the lectures. Professor Robert Cushman, a well-known authority on constitution law in the Department of Government, gave three others. Two were presented by faculty from the College of Agriculture, Professors Warren, that's the Warren of Warren Hall, and Lamont, and one by Professor Bosworth of the College of Architecture. 6 other lectures were delivered by well-known authorities who were paid the magnificent sum each of $50 as an honorarium. Clark reported that his lecture course attracted 51 undergraduates and 16 graduate students from the colleges of architecture, arts and sciences, engineering, and agriculture. And he also provided a detailed list of the seminar research papers, their authors, and their college affiliation. And that is a fascinating list to look at. I have a copy of that as well. Now, there's a mystery here. Clark had signed on to a program that specifically was not intended to train professional planners. Not like the one that Carnegie had funded a year or two earlier at MIT. Instead, the Cornell approach was to give future lawyers, bankers, business executives, industrialists, engineers, and architects a generous coating of planning with the hope that it would stick long enough so that they would become strong supporters of the urban planning movement. So what happened? What happened in 1941 that led Cornell to seek and obtain approval from the New York State Regents of the professional advanced degree that you have, MRP, Master in Regional Planning? I should know the answer, but I don't. I had the opportunity, if I had thought of it, and I didn't, to ask Tom McAsee if he could tell me about this. But we can guess. By that time, Clark had become very deeply involved in his professional work. He was designing most of the projects that Robert Moses had sponsored, and by 1938, he'd become dean of the college. So he had less time for teaching, and that's why, surely, he sought out Tom McAsee. Tom had been trained as an architect at MIT, then had been a member of that first class of master's, the MCP degree that MIT had just begun to offer. Now, did Clark bring Tom here because he had decided to change the goal of the Cornell program? It's possible. My guess is, again, it's just that, but I suspect it was Tom who, once here, convinced Clark that a thin coating of planning on professionals of other fields was all well and good, but what was really needed was a program that would be educating full-blown professionals in the field. There's probably some correspondence in the university archives someplace that would answer the question. One result of the peculiar way in which our program began is that either by intent or accident, from the very beginning, students could be admitted with an undergraduate degree in virtually any academic discipline. We were thus the first and for many years the only program that dared to, or by oversight did, admit students with degrees in the social sciences or the humanities. I am here because to be admitted to MIT in 1946, I was told that I would have to spend an entire semester studying land surveying. A useful occupation, perhaps, but I didn't feel that I was any George Washington. Anyway, MIT, thank you for that decision, because that's what led me to Cornell. And so it was that 65 years ago, a letter arrived at my barracks admitting me to this program as an MRP candidate. And in March of that year, I and seven other students, most of them like me, just out of uniform, began the spring term of the first true class to study for the degree. We didn't have much of a choice of what to take. There were only seven courses in planning: history, principles, practice, housing, zoning, a studio in planning design, and a field problem. Now, those courses, if you total all the credit hours, added up to only about 29 hours. And then, in addition to that, we had a thesis requirement that customarily was 7 to 10 hours, depending upon the nature of the project. Each of us had to select a minor outside the college. Usually that involved a couple of courses and maybe some directed reading, possibly 8 to 10 hours. The rest of the credit time to the 60 hours required, these were electives. There was a major focus on the fall term studio in planning design and on the spring term field problem. Because we entered out of phase, we entered in the spring term, our group was immediately plunged into preparing a so-called master plan for the city of Auburn. It was a terrible study, but it was the best we could do under the circumstances. Later projects were much, much better because students had an entire academic year taking introductory and intermediate, maybe some advanced courses, before they were immersed in the idea of being turned loose on some unsuspecting town in the Finger Lakes, or perhaps on a place like Gary, Indiana, where Casey Parsons did a project one time. Tom Mackesy was our only teacher in planning, but he also served as acting dean, and so he didn't have much time. Clark was listed as teaching two courses, and we all knew this great man was the great authority on parkways and parks, but it turned out to be a fiction. He made a token appearance one day in class and told some stories about Robert Moses, and that was about it. So for much of the time, we taught ourselves. We learned by reading and discussion and argument with one another. For the fall term studio course, we all had a drafting table in a big studio room, and it was there where we spent most of our time outside of classes or the library. I learned about site planning from one who later became dean of a design college and from another fellow student who planned a large addition to the town of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and then later many, many huge suburbs of Tucson, Arizona. They may have learned something from me about what I thought I knew about land use regulations, population analysis, and municipal government and administration. By the academic year 1948-49, and by the way, we are not going all the way to the present. We are going to cut off well along this line. I'm sure you're counting the pages here. By the academic year 1948-49, there were no new planning courses, but there was a program that identified a typical two-year curriculum. So in addition to the seven planning courses, two courses were given in the College of Agriculture that most of the students took: land economics and conservation of natural resources. There were three other courses in arts and sciences that were also available: urban sociology, public administration, and statistics. So there was that backup from other colleges. In addition to Mackesy, the college included the half-time services of Fred Edmondson, who was a landscape architect, a very talented person, and he taught the design studio. Beginning in January of 1948, and for the next five terms, I drove over from Broome County, where I was planning director, to teach seminars in planning law and housing. After I returned from a Fulbright year in England, Tom offered me a teaching position beginning in January 1952. I accepted, privately telling myself I'd give this a try for 3 or 4 years and then move on to the real world. No one else would take me, so I'm still here. My first years of teaching were really tough. While Tom continued to teach his course in planning history, everything else except the design studio was my responsibility. Now, the immediate and daunting task was to prepare lectures for the course grandly called Principles of City and Regional Planning. That we then had terms 15 weeks long, and this course met three times a week. So 3 lectures times 15. That was required of all planning students in their first year, and it was also a requirement for all undergraduates in architecture in the first semester of their fourth year. I taught that course for the next 17 years, and in addition to virtually all of the planners, my grade books record the names of Cornell's most distinguished architectural graduates. At reunions, I make it a practice to ask them if my course did them any permanent damage. They deny this. That pleases me. Years ago, architecture dropped this course from their list of requirements. I have never been able to understand how that program, one of the best in the country, can allow students to move into a world in which they will be marinated in urban issues throughout their careers without some academic introduction to the issues, theories, methods, and techniques of this closely allied field. And I feel just as strongly there's another sentence in this paragraph. I feel just as strongly that planners need to understand there is more to urban planning than social science research. Both architects and planners, I think, would profit immeasurably from a joint course in real estate tailored for their needs that would focus on collaborative solutions to one of the realistic annual national competitions, such as the one sponsored by the Urban Land Institute. There is really no good reason why we can't do this in the college. Now, during my first years here, in addition to teaching 2 and 3 courses a term, I decided on admissions, advised most of the students, supervised most of the thesis projects. In addition, I was trying to establish contacts with other departments, identifying suitable elective courses, and beginning to bring in, on a very limited budget, a few outside speakers. And because the support staff was non-existent, I did not say limited, I said because support staff was non-existent, I typed, signed, licked envelopes, and applied postage to all outgoing correspondents. And I was also expected to do my share in serving on the architectural thesis committees, occasionally being asked to serve as the chair of that committee. No wonder my wife and I did not have our first child until some years later. Sometime in 1956, Tom Mackesy and I had lunch with Sandy Atwood, the university provost. Tom told Sandy we could use another person in our program. Sandy asked for a formal request. Tom wrote a letter. Sandy replied with an approval. We both knew who we wanted. Kermit K.C. Parsons, who'd been in the first class I taught, and who was then on the staff of the Cleveland City Planning Commission. We made the offer, and K.C. accepted. At least in our college at that time, the elaborate mating rituals of faculty recruitment that now prevail were unknown. Maybe they were used in other colleges, but not in ours. We had the money, we made an offer, it was accepted. Casey and Jan arrived in 1957, and immediately my life became easier and the program became far better. We worked very well together. He took over some of the courses I had been teaching, and we both developed new courses. By then, Mackesy was dean of the college. He still taught history. He was available for thesis advising. Field problems were growing in size and sophistication. Fred Edmondson ran the design studio, and his class produced several impressive studies, usually of far-off places like Hawaii or Colorado or the Bahamas. Some of you, I know, were in those courses. Fred Clark, a planning consultant, came once a week during the spring term to teach planning administration. Coleman Woodbury, a very distinguished former housing administrator and academic, taught a fall term course called Public Problems in Urban Land Use. And we had other resources we could draw on. Most of the students took a wonderful course in the Civil Engineering College, School of Civil Engineering, then called Air Photo Interpretation, later changed to Remote Sensing. I also prevailed on that college, that school, to offer a course in municipal engineering for non-engineers. Known as Mains and Drains, it was universally regarded as the worst course in North America. On a far happier note, Glenn Beyer, who had been named director of the Housing Research Center, then at first housed in Home Economics, moved his whole office down to our building in Sibley and took over the course in housing and what became a valuable resource for students who were interested in that subject. Most important at that time was our close association with Miller Hill House in what was then the Graduate School of Business and Public Administration. He was a noted authority, nationally known, authority on municipal administration and urban finance. That wise and courtly man taught in so well. Virtually all of our students took his two courses, and his students in city management, which was a curriculum that Miller and I put together one afternoon, literally on the back of an envelope, handed it to his dean. His dean sent it over to the catalog that was just being published, and without consulting his faculty, decreed that there would be a course leading to the master's degree in public administration in city management. The students, Miller's students, took from 1 to 6 courses in our program, and we created a joint degree program that led in 3 years to 2 master's degrees, one in regional planning, one in public administration. We also worked out similar joint programs with the law school and with engineering. Now, consider the implications of that program like that, as it stood at the end of the 1950s. It assumed that in 2 years of graduate work, a student could master all of the fundamentals of planning and be fully qualified to begin a professional career. And note also the normative thrust of most of the courses. We assumed that planning was a prescriptive, not a descriptive discipline. We saw and taught planning as an action-oriented activity focused on the physical elements of cities and regions. Now, in that, we reflected the state of planning practice in the country. How do we do this with a 2-person department? That sounds ridiculous. But it was not then to be scorned. The professional society, the American Institute of Planners, maintained a list of so-called approved programs or recognized programs. Until sometime beyond the mid-50s, the principal requirement for an approved program was to have 1 full-time faculty member solely devoted to teaching courses in planning. I recall vividly how those who were associated with some of the minor programs complained bitterly when the requirement was raised to 2. We all envied MIT with its huge faculty of 3 persons. There was at least 1 virtue in small numbers. Departmental faculty meetings took place in a fraction of the time that later became normal. Agendas, Casey and I decided what we were going to talk about as we walked over to lunch. By the time of dessert, we'd made the decisions, meeting adjourned. Now, the 60s was a fascinating time to be around here. It was a decade of substantial expansion in the college and the department under Burnham Kelly, who began his 10-year deanship just as I came back from my first sabbatical. I spent the first half of that at Berkeley in the fall of 1958, and there I met Barclay Jones. With Steve Jacobs, he had just completed a research project on historic preservation. He had studied architecture as an undergraduate. He had a master's degree in planning, and he was working on his dissertation in economics. I thought, here is a 4-for-1 shot. And when Burnham came in the early 60s, I asked him to seek an additional line and invite Barclay to fill it. Now, Barclay's contribution to this program was transformative. I am not going to go into that because it is so complicated and so important. But since I was in a sort of a parallel track, I am not the best person to discuss that. But you will see the effect of that in a moment as I read you another list. Burnham also enriched the resources of our program when he appointed Stuart Stein to the faculty. At first, Stu was supposed to be half-time in architecture and half-time with us. He had degrees in both architecture and planning from MIT, and he had just finished with his consulting partner this widely acclaimed study of College Hill, a preservation study that is still cited as one of the great pieces of work of planning. So in theory, he was to be half and half, but it didn't work out very well, as is sometimes true when we're trying to work across discipline lines. And Stu suddenly, soon became entirely one of us. Somehow, Burnham found funding also for an urban geographer, an urban ecologist, a regional scientist, and several part-time and temporary appointments. and he also took us out of the confines of Tompkins County. He began a program in New York City. There's a little story here I have to tell you. Before he arrived as dean, in the summer after he'd finished at MIT, he was well connected, and he went to a foundation in New York, and he came up with $200,000. He reported that when he arrived to the president of the university, and he was severely scolded for doing this, being told that fundraising for the college was a university activity. You are not to do that, Dean Kelly. Much later, another president chided us for not raising enough money. A little incident that cloud an otherwise pleasant career. Well, he started a program in New York City, and that architects were able to go down there and spend a term or two. Under Parsons and Stein, our planners were able to do an intern program during the summer months. Burnham also led a team of us to Puerto Rico to advise the university chancellor on the location of new schools of architecture and planning, and also to recommend the first heads of those programs. And that began a long association with the University of Puerto Rico that brought a stream of well-qualified, wonderful people from Puerto Rico here to study, provided the entry door to our department for Pierre Clavel and Bill Goldsmith. And so that was the department that Casey Parsons became chair of in 1964. Fast forward to the end of that decade, we then had a faculty of 12, nine of whom were full-time. Most of the old courses remained, and others similar in approach had been added. But the vastly expanded offerings in new directions signaled a fundamental shift in content and emphasis. I just want to read you the titles of some of those courses. Human Ecology, Industrial Location and Regional Development, Seminar in Urban and Regional Theory, Advanced Urban and Regional Theory, Seminar in Planning Theory, Urban Land Policy and Programs, Planning Analysis, Regional Social Accounting, Regional Inter-Industry Analysis and Programming, Research Methods in Planning, Urban Geographic Analysis, Operations Research in Planning, Systems Designing, Workshop and Heuristic Gaming Techniques, Economics of Intrametropolitan Land Use, Regional Planning, State Planning, Soviet and East European Regional and Urban Planning, Environmental Health Planning, Neighborhood Theory, Seminar in Neighborhood Theory, Social Facilities Planning, Human Resources Development Planning, Institutional Planning. So the new emphasis on theory and on economic and social issues is unmistakable. This responded both to emerging issues and problems, and I think also a broadened perception of the nature of planning as we thought through some of the issues. The increase in faculty size and diversity of viewpoints was not an unmixed blessing, however. There was no longer a sense that we all shared the same outlook toward the field of planning. We began to disagree vigorously and sometimes not always politely or without rancor on how the field was to be defined in academic terms. We got down on the mat with one another, arguing about that most basic of academic arguments, who is going to get the next line. Eventually, we split into two departments. One concentrated on the physical city, bringing to those studies the normative or prescriptive approach. The other one leaned more to fundamental research into the very nature of urban and regional phenomena and in developing theoretical constructs to explain the forces at work. As it turned out, both departments prospered, attracted students, but after a few years, with some urging from the dean's office, and certainly some severe prodding from Day Hall, from the university administration, we reunited in 1976. Divorce turned out to be really good for us, although I've never been able to understand why it was that once back together, we began to act like adults. We were civil to one another, and once more could disagree without being disagreeable. Now, there are many, many more chapters to this story, but it will be for others to take it up on future occasions. A lot of this is covered in the marvelous book that you have as part of this celebration. One of the most important will be to trace the changes in faculty and student composition from a bunch of middle-class white guys to what now looks more like a cross-section of the people of the world. We are not there yet, but I'm confident it will not take another 75 years to reach that. It's been a wonderful experience to see all of you. We're just starting this celebration, and I want to talk to all of you more. Thank you for coming to spend these days with us. I wish you well, and I thank you for letting me share my memories of these early days of planning at Cornell. Thank you.